Good morning. It's another Friday, and this is now the 60th episode of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. And it is real and unscripted. I'm here again. I'm John, and I'm here with Jeremy, my son and business partner at John Zogby Strategies. And we're here to chat for 20 or 25 minutes or so about the news of the week. And no matter which way I cut it, Jer, there are some stories that we have to talk about. But first of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I just can't even imagine where you're going to start.
Okay, well, I'm looking at the three C's this week. The first is COVID rescue. The second is Cuomo. And the third is the Crown. I think those are the three major stories of the week, at least as far as the media is concerned. And so let's start with COVID, because that's maybe the hottest right now. The president gave a speech, signed major piece of legislation. Arguably, according to most pundits, this may be both the biggest and the last big victory of his presidency, of his tenure. But let's look at the bill. Supporters are saying this is what's needed to boost the economy, to give people some spending, give them some hope, get money directly, not only to people, but also to cities and to small businesses, to families. Critics are saying it's way too much money, and that the harshest critics saying, look, this is going so far beyond COVID relief that it's unrecognizable, that there's too much political pork in this. I'm a supporter. I'm a student of FDR and Lyndon Johnson, experienced Lyndon Johnson. And sometimes you need to prime the pump. Get it going. So I come out in favor. I think the timing is right because we're not at rock bottom. Critics are saying this, if we're going to spend any kind of money, we should have spent it months ago when we were at rock bottom. But now we're digging ourselves out of recession. There is significant job growth. Unemployment is down. People are feeling hopeful because of the vaccines. Why are we spending this kind of money now? I think the money is absolutely necessary. What do you think?
It's always a tough thing, right? Because if you criticize it, then you appear that you don't care about human suffering. But I'm reminded of the old story of the broken window fallacy. I won't tell the story, but I would encourage people to listen to the story. It's a great metaphor and analogy for basic economic policy, which basically says there's the seen and there's the unseen. Media tends to report the seen effects, but tends to ignore the longer term unseen effects. I mean, right off the bat, way too much money being criticism and political pork. I think that's spot on. I came across somebody by the name of Anthony Pompliano, who I actually thought was a buffoon until I read this article. I mean, maybe he still is a buffoon, but he wrote an intelligent piece. He's a Bitcoin enthusiast, probably about my age, maybe a little bit older. And, you know, in short, he pointed out a Washington Post article the other day that the headline ran, "The COVID-19 relief package is reducing poverty," something to the effect, talking about it in the present form. I mean, the checks haven't even gone out yet, and they're saying it's reducing poverty. That's a bit of a stretch. But in short, he goes on and he says, all right, well, let's dissect and let's look at the numbers. And Dad, you already alluded to this. The majority of the money is going to broke governments, Illinois, New York, California. Now, whether it was those three states or if it instead went to Texas, Florida, and South Dakota, that doesn't matter to me whether it's red or blue. What really matters to me is that the majority of the money is going to third parties, right? Middle, middle men and middle women. If this is humanitarian and this is relief, why not send the money directly to the people, to the many, to the 99%? And so that's a problem. And you alluded to it. It's a lot of that money, more than half of it, is going to go to pork. And a lot of that money, yes, it will filter its way through, but it's also going to potentially, I don't think potentially, I think likely enhance hands that are already wealthy and powerful. So on the notion of priming the pump and going back to the broken window fallacy of seeing, looking at the seen effects versus the unseen effects, I would encourage our listeners to look at two things. And you can just get definitions. These are important aspects of economics. One is the quantitative theory of money. That sounds, you know, mind-boggling, but it's the definition is actually simple. And then after you look that up, and it's an incredibly simple definition, there's the Cantillon effect. And so those talk to and speak to the unseen effects of policies that only look at and champion and use media and public relations to say, here are the good things, all the while ignoring the long-term pain.
All right, you know, as always, I learn a lot by listening to you. By the same token, though, money going directly to state and local governments need not be a bad thing. You know, there are critics who will say too large to fail is in effect again. But we don't want local governments to go bankrupt. We don't want state governments to not be able to pay their obligations and to do good things. We need to separate out, is there corruption in our world? There is. Is there corruption too often on state and local levels? Absolutely, unequivocally. And that calls for a different level of action. But at this point in time, there are huge revenue shortfalls and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of employees who are facing layoffs. I mean, state and local employees, and millions, even billions of services that can't be delivered. And that doesn't even get into the fact that by law, state and local governments must have balanced budgets. And if they don't have the capacity to do that, then something somehow has to be done. So I'm still a supporter. I'm going to say a strong supporter of the COVID relief package. Is it flawed? Oh, absolutely. It's flawed. But necessary nonetheless.
But I mean, it's like, if I have bad credit and I go to the bank and I ask for a loan, they say, well, we're not going to give you a loan. You have terrible credit. You're living beyond your means. You've been in debt for so long. Your expenditures far outweigh your revenue. Well, I'm describing those particular governments. If they have a history of being horrible with their fiscal and financial house, they can't get their financial and fiscal house in order, giving them billions of dollars isn't going to incentivize them. I understand that you present, you say, well, what's going to happen to the government workers? I mean, that's another debate about reallocation of capital. But we can have that debate, but, you know, maybe for another time as we start to see the effects of this COVID, long-term effects of the COVID-19 relief. But I mean, again, on principle, you're giving money to broke people. You're giving money to people who can't manage their money. And we saw how that worked out in leading up to the 2008 crisis, where, you know, they were just doling out loans to people who were going to go underwater, who were going to have their homes foreclosed. It's the same thing here. The spending is going to go wild. It's going to be irresponsible. The cronies and those connected are going to get a lot of the money. They already have mansions. They already have a great life. I mean, why are we to assume that that's going to stop? If anything, it's going to be amplified and incentivized.
There is a substantial difference between Countrywide, Wells Fargo on one hand, and the auto companies and the city of Indianapolis or Chicago on the other hand. You know, Countrywide did not have to provide for public works. It did not have to have clean water or a park system, run a police force or a fire department, teach school, have teachers paid in schools. That was selfish money going to stockholders. And they should have paid. They have paid, probably nowhere near enough. But the city of Chicago or the city of fill in the blank has social contractual obligations to its cities. When there is corruption, then if the criminal justice system fails and falls down, that's a whole other issue that has to be dealt with. But in the meantime, people suffer if cities and other forms of local government cannot function.
Why don't we come to a compromise? First of all, I would say the analogy was, I stated the analogy because of the overarching principle of incentivization. Countrywide and Wells Fargo were incentivized by the Fed, who sets the interest rates. They set the interest rates low, the big banks follow. If the Fed never set the interest rate in the first place and allowed the banks to determine for themselves and for there to be something to, akin to price discovery, you wouldn't have a race to, okay, let's lend out money at the most ultra low rate. So it incentivized them. That came from the Fed from the federal government. So that was the analogy. But on to the compromise, why not make terms and conditions? Say, if you're going to take this money, allocate it to police, fire departments, and education, and make it transparent. Show the public the budget and release the public to the public how the money is going to be allocated. But these things are almost never done. The money's handed over to local and statewide leadership. And by the way, if this is going on at the local and statewide level, imagine how it's going on at the federal level. We almost never have transparency. We should at least be able to see, where is this money going? This should all be on a platform that we can sign into and see how the money is being allocated, so we can make sure that it's not, you know, going into deep pockets, right?
In principle, I agree with that. And we're not going to get into this now. I'm just going to state it, and then hopefully we can talk about it in the future. This was the whole debate that was launched during and after the Great Society. Lyndon Johnson launched through the Great Society and the War on Poverty what were known as categorical grants. These were grants that went directly to cities, directly to states, with earmarks as to how they were supposed to be spent and how reportage was supposed to come back in the interests of transparency. And what happened was there was still an enormous amount of waste on the local level, and local government officials saying, this is the long arm of the federal government telling us how to run our business. That is against the principles of the Constitution. That's when Nixon came in and changed, I'm going to say 90%, but I'm going to say most of those categorical grants into block grants. So the money, same amount of money, maybe a little less, will go directly to cities, but within broader parameters. We're not going to tell you what to spend them on. You determine how to spend them on. And needless to say, some of the priorities were really wacky. Some of the priorities, in fact, were anti-constitutional. You know, building an all-white men's golf course in the city of Birmingham, Alabama, was counter to what that money should be about. Plus, it was anti-constitutional. In any event, that is an ongoing debate.
Well, let me ask a question. Is it anti-constitutional to in this situation, to demand full transparency? I mean, a public audit. I mean, I really think a citizen should have every right to go into a municipal building and say, open up your books. If you had, maybe the requirement being you have to be a CPA or you have to be a bookkeeper. All of this stuff should be open to the, because it's coming from their money. It's coming from their pockets.
Well, I do think, and I'm not disagreeing with you, but let's just end this by saying that there is FOIA, Freedom of Information Act. And yes, any citizen can come in and file for that. In fact, that's how any of this ever gets reported. There's just so much of it, though, that I don't know that we could ever catch up with the sheer volume of spending reports that we have to.
Yeah, because by the time that you would get granted the document, it would probably be months, 6 months, a year. That's why I'm saying cut the middleman out, allow the public, allow allotted time for people to schedule to come in and see the books. You know, like we can see the Library of Congress.
Agreed. So let's go to the second C. I have been anyway on a Cuomo death watch here in terms of politics. I'm already on the record here and a few media quotes as saying he's finished, and that it's just simply a matter of time that he leaves the governorship. He, of course, adamantly disagrees with that. He will never resign. Wait until the Attorney General's report comes out. But I think we're into a different period right now. As of this morning, and a reminder, this is Friday morning, a majority of state legislators, including growing and significant numbers of Democrats, are calling upon him to resign. Movement is afoot among a significant number of legislators, not a handful, but a significant number of legislators, including some of his allies, that if he does, to launch an impeachment investigation. The most recent report about a young woman who was groped aggressively, as they say, in the governor's mansion, has gone to the New York State Police as a criminal investigation. And it appears, at least as of this moment, that the walls are closing in on the governor. What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, it was 59 Democrats, right?
59 Democrats.
And that's a majority.
Actually 60.
And that's a majority of the Democratic Assembly, right?
It is. It's a majority of the Assembly, and it's a majority, incidentally. With 60 Democrats, add to that the Republicans.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. And then in the Senate, it's also majority in the Senate, including enough Democrats with Republicans. And that's just so far.
Yeah. He's toast. I'm not on Facebook, but I get relayed some of the chatter that's going on. And what's mind boggling to me are the Cuomo supporters who are just in complete denial. I mean, even apparently this is even coming from females who are just saying, you know, so what? He planted a kiss. So what? He kissed somebody on the hand. Well, no, it wasn't a kiss on the hand. And it was aggressive. And people, you know, these women were intimidated. Here's a guy who's on record saying, I will destroy you. Said it numerous times and has a whole history of all kinds of major problems. I mean, Buffalo Billion and Kelly Arrows. We could go on and on. I just wonder when are his supporters going to follow and stop believing in him? Because it's clear. There needs to be an investigation, right? We can't just say, okay, he's totally guilty. But the pattern is there, and his statements and his rebuttals aren't helping them. They really do appear to admit guilt. I think so. But you know, I think right now, and I said this last week, everybody's focused on the sexual harassment, which is absolutely huge. But do not lose sight of the nursing home scandal in which people died and data was fraudulently, you know, mismanaged. Those are crimes. Those are also crimes. So are we going to see Cuomo in handcuffs? And then, you know, I got to say, one of our regular listeners pointed this out to me a couple weeks ago, and I thought this was brilliant. It's just a question. This is to our listeners. Let us know what you think about this. But if I have my timeline correct, the messing with the data was going on in July, right? And then the excuse was that, oh no, well we were doing that to ward off Trump criticisms. What else was going on in July? If my memory serves me well, in July, that's when he had that sweet multi-million-dollar book deal. And so is there a connection as to, you know, why there was a cover up and why he's trying to divert the attention and say he did it because of Trump, when maybe it was more so that he didn't want to lose that book deal? I don't know. Maybe that's maybe we need a Sherlock Holmes here.
Well, I'll tell you, broadly speaking, above and beyond Andrew Cuomo, what is very troubling to me is the selective situational morality. You know, Donald Trump says and does the most repulsive things, and Christian conservatives say, but he's our guy. You know, he's pro-life, he's pro-guns, he's pro-God. He's done so much for our community, leave him alone. Bill Clinton, I don't care if the intern is 62 years old. An intern is a subordinate. But, you know, liberals, on the other hand, say, yes, but he's good on the issues. Al Franken, good on the issues. He's good for women. So what if he's got private peccadilloes? You know, all right, let's say we can't have one size fits all, you know, and there are people who genuinely make mistakes. But when there are patterns of behavior, what troubles me is the selective situational morality that's involved. If the other guy has a behavioral pattern, but he's good on the issues, then that's good enough for me. It's more important to have the larger issue dealt with, which is he's good for me and he's good for us and good for the nation. So what if he has some personal peccadilloes? But if the other guy is engaged in a certain kind of behavior, then he's wrong, he's a pig. He should be removed. He should go to prison. This is one of the aspects of this hyperpartisanship that I find very, very troubling. There's got to be, to some degree, a standard for what is moral, a standard for what is ethical, a standard for what you can get away with or what you are allowed for. Yes, we are human. Yes, all of us in some way, shape, or form make mistakes. But when we continue to rewrite the rules of engagement to fit our own ideological or personal needs, I just find that very troubling.
It is. And you know, I've been calling out political tribalism for a couple months now. So, I mean, just because I'm focusing on Cuomo, you know, and a few weeks ago we were blasting Ted Cruz. No, you're absolutely right, and I agree with that. We can't just say, oh well, when it's our guy, let's go down with the ship, but when it's the other guy, attack. That is tribal, and I'm afraid to say that it's starting to move beyond tribalism. It's starting to get cultish.
Like, yeah.
Politicians should not be cult-like personalities. That really should have no place in American politics, just because of you know, I mean, our nation was founded on the principle. I think the overarching theme was you shouldn't trust a massively bloated government to run your life and tell you what to do. when you have that situation, you're going to attract the worst type of personalities. I think that's where we are today, whether you're Republican, Democrat, Democrat, Republican. That's how it is to me.
So let me ask you a question. Next week, when we're sitting here, will he be sitting Governor Cuomo or former governor?
It's looking less so, but never underestimate a massive ego. I mean, that man has one of the largest egos I've ever seen. It's looking less so that he will be governor by next week. But if there was a person that will fight it out, it's him.
I can't say it better. So let's leave it at that.
Yeah,
I agree. Okay, let's go across the pond, back and forth here. I don't think you watched, did you, any or all of the Meghan Markle interview?
I can't.
No. Oh, good. Right, so I get my head.
I just can't.
So I'll do all the talking. Is it safe to say you don't really care about that?
I'm not going to say it's a purposeful distraction, but it serves as a distraction from the real topic, you know.
So, but two issues have come up. Royal family aside, and of course, it was all about the royal family. But the two issues that came up, first of all, was her Meghan. That is, reporting that there were points that her depression was so severe that she didn't want to live anymore. I don't think she came right out and said she contemplated suicide, but she did say the walls were closing in on her. There were no friends, no one to defend her, and that she didn't want to live anymore. And, of course, given the fact that the brothers, her husband and brother-in-law, had made such a big deal about supporting mental health, particularly when their mother was in the same situation, that this reflected poorly on the royal family, that one of them, Meghan, announced that she had been crying out, actually gone to the palace and said, please find me some help. I can't find it for myself, and I basically am a prisoner behind these four walls. That was one issue. The second issue was the very mysterious conversation where she said that what came up was, how dark will this baby be? And of course, that generates all sorts of questions about racism within Buckingham Palace. Oprah Winfrey has since said that that's neither Prince Philip or the Queen. So that leaves as suspect Harry's brother, William, or as always, the flat catcher, the Prince of Wales, Charles. Is this much ado about nothing, or has she raised some serious issues? And finally, do you believe her or not believe her?
You know, I have no way of knowing. I thought you were going to talk about the Piers Morgan story, which I only, you know, anecdotally know about. I can't go into detail. My understanding is he said something. I think he said it was a bunch of rubbish, and people were saying, oh, how dare you, you know, take back what you said, take back what you said. And he said, you know what, I'm not going to. So to me, it all ties back to, I don't like the term cancel culture. It's just too trendy. That's one of those terminologies that's going to come and go. I mean, let's just call it what it is. It's an assault on freedom of thought. It's an assault on freedom of speech. So I think it really, to me, that's the overarching thing is, you know, if the funny thing is, the people who are running the show on the so-called cancel culture are just as aggressive and hateful as the people that they're going after. I mean, they're going after now Dr. Seuss. They're going after Pepe Le Pew. You know, like Pepe Le Pew really had any impact on how, you know, I would approach asking a girl out to a date. I mean, give me a break. I think they would have had a better argument to say that it was culturally insensitive towards the French and that, you know, it generalized them as all passionate lovers. So, but it's beyond Pepe Le Pew and Dr. Seuss. You know, I've talked about math is racist. Do you even know your history? The numbers that we use today come from the Arabs, Egyptians, Babylonians, Persians, Chinese, Mayans, Aztecs were all geniuses of mathematics. Maybe, you know, in our tradition, it probably, I don't know if I can say it comes more from the Greek and the Roman and the European. All of that was inherited from previous civilizations, which come from the continent of Asia.
We're all the sum total of everyone who's ever lived on this
planet. Exactly. I mean, math is a universal language. If there's anything that isn't racist, it should be the study of mathematics because it sees numbers. It doesn't see skin color. But the ironic thing is all skin colors. It's a vile, dangerous worldview it's very akin to Mao's Cultural Revolution when the students would, you know, basically pull the professor out into the streets and mangle them.
Couple of quickies and then we'll call it a week. A cancel culture, of course, is very, very dangerous. And political correctness is coming to haunt, I think, in particular, higher education. Number one, Piers Morgan, I really didn't want to talk about him, but you raised it. Piers Morgan walked off the set and then quit. And he was not being canceled. He had had free rein for several years, almost every day attacking Meghan Markle. It was just part of his shtick. He was hurt by the fact that she rejected him after she met Harry. But in this special instance, right after the Oprah interview, he was out attacking her and saying that the whole bit about mental illness was a big lie. And it was a colleague of his who challenged him. And that's when he had his hissy fit, walked off, said, I'm not putting up with any of this anymore. So he was not fired from that show. He was just challenged for his views. And frankly, that's about as much as I'll ever want to talk about Piers Morgan ever again as long as I live. In terms of just the whole broad impact, I think that it's larger than the royal family. It's the history of Britain and the whole issue of race and racism. It's larger than Meghan, and it's larger than the Queen or Prince Charles. And I think this may have launched a much needed conversation in the UK. That's really all I have to say. I don't have a fourth C, so we did COVID, Cuomo, and the Crown. Mm. What do you think? We done?
I always want to go on longer, but I guess in the interest of time, I do have something that I want to say, but I should talk about it next week.
All right, what is it? And that'll tease for next week, but then it won't be spontaneous and unrehearsed.
You know, I detest racism and race warfare. I detest classism and class warfare. They've just in the 20th century alone have led to tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of death. If I had the time to do the math, I could get the correct number, but it's somewhere in between there. Racism is a disgusting thing, but I think there's a tendency to only see that it comes from Western societies. But yet we know that racism is on every continent. I think unless I'm misinterpreting this, I want to be careful in what I perceive to be the general notion that racism is most powerful in Western nations. Racism is very real in the Middle East. We know that as being from the Middle East, you know, from what we've read about in Gulf nations and their treatment of people from India and people from Bangladesh, in China, in Japan, Korea, even, I mean, maybe not racism, but ethnicism in the continent of Africa, which existed before colonialism, where tribes were at brutal warfare. I mean, all over the world. And I just wish that there wasn't a tendency from certain people to think that it only comes from Western culture. It's a very real and dangerous thing that needs to be treated as a global phenomenon, not just an American, British, Canadian, you know, whatever, you know, English-speaking phenomenon or European phenomenon. The only way that we will be able to tackle racism is if we understand that it is within every country, and that it's a dangerous form of hate, just like classism and class warfare, which are institutionalized envy, which look what it did in Soviet Russia. Look what it did in Poland, the Iron Curtain.
Okay, you said it, and we'll raise that again, probably next week.
Sure.
Have a good
week. That was the fourth C, classism, I guess.
Classism. Okay. Hey, I'll see you. In fact, I'll talk to you shortly.
Take care.